Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head-on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
Well, good evening, and look at the sunset behind here, live from Houston, Texas. Isn't that beautiful? Good to have everybody here on this Sunday night. I'm checking to make sure our Facebook Live is up and running. Hopefully, it'll be get going here just shortly. But welcome to the program tonight. It's great to have you with us. We are here for another hour of just good, I believe, not only stories. We just don't want to just tell stories, but also to how people can work through things, how they deal with things, how there's always hope, how you battle through things, and how you just don't think you can make it another day. And you hear a story of courage and inspiration that gives you the extra little bit of fuel that you need to be able to make it through another week. And to be honest with you, in this world that we live in of total chaos, it's nice every now and then just to be able to sit back and go, okay, I want to hear how somebody made it through something. And maybe I can apply some of those things into my life next week, or to a friend of yours that's going through pain or suffering right now. 888-627-6008. We would love to have you join in. We actually have Mr. Doug Newsom watching the switchboard tonight and running the controls at the BBS radio station, the best radio network, I think, in the country. And Doug is right there. So if you want to call in that 888-627-6008, you will hear his radio voice, and he will take care of you and patch you right into the program with our guest tonight. Next week, you're not going to want to miss. It's a great story. And James Carey will be here next week. That'll be Labor Day weekend, believe it or not, the first Sunday night in September, live right here, 8 p.m. Central Time from Houston, Texas. James Carey next week. And all of our guests already have a book throughout the month of September. It's going to be some wonderful, wonderful people you don't want to miss. Get on the phone, tweet somebody, text somebody, say, hey, you wanted to listen in tonight? And we'd love to have you participate and join in. Tonight we have with us the wife, I think let's call her the better half of a guest that we had a few weeks ago, Mike Pritchard, we had from Fresno, California, and his wife, Darlene, has her own story. And after hearing some of that, I said, hey, Mike, she would be a great, he said, oh yeah, she'll be a better guest than me. So we booked her tonight, and Darlene Pritchard is a successful HR staff analyst who works in for one of the Fresno County special districts. She claims she's happily married, and I believe that, has two grown daughters, a stepson, four grandchildren, and her life is joyful today, which I want to make sure we underline that, circle that, and highlight that in the story, because you're going to see somebody that has some joy in her life right now. But she is a survivor of severe childhood sexual abuse that led to a life of drug addiction, cycles of toxic relationships. And I don't know of anybody that has been abused that hasn't had a cycle of toxic relationships, because it affects that part of our lives. And nearly a visit trip to prison. And through court intervention, treatment, and spirituality, Darlene overcame the odds. And this is going to be an inspirational story tonight. And I know you want to be able to hear how she made it on her road to recovery. And I'm looking forward to listening to this story because I don't know the whole thing. So welcome from Fresno, California, Miss Darlene Pritchard. Darlene, you there?
Yes, thank you for having me tonight.
How are you?
I'm doing good.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I know your husband's right there. Hopefully he won't jump in unless we say something wrong. And I think you'll be able to hold your own, to be honest with you. Tell us what you do, Darlene. What's going on out there in Fresno right now?
So at one point in time, I was a hairstylist. And doing that for a while, my hand gave out on me. And Michael helped push me through college when we were married. And I got my BS degree in business administration and then started working for Fresno County. And it took a minute to become a staff analyst, but I did. And I ended up getting in HR and I found that I really liked human resources, which everybody tells me I'm weird, but it's just something that I can connect to. I like connecting to the people and helping them out. And no matter what arena it may look like, you know, there's leave of absences, there's just all kinds of things that people will come and talk to you about. And I've always been that way, even with everything that's happened throughout my life. I've always been an open book, and it's been a hard road to do that. I mean, it's not been the easiest, but so today I continue with human resources. And every day is a new challenge and a new learning ability for me. So that's kind of what I do besides take care of the family and support Michael because he's got a lot of different avenues going on in his life. I mean, as far as different, you know, jobs and what have you. So as much as I can be of a support to him, I am. And then, of course, there's the grandbabies and they're number one.
And you need better than grandbabies, doesn't it?
Oh, no.
That's the perfect. I wish I had grandbabies first, but I don't think that was possible. No, exactly. Grandbabies are awesome. I love them. So, Darlene, tell me, and we can work into this as deep as you want. We can drill down as deep as you want to go. I'm sure I'm going to try to chase out a couple rabbits as you tell the story. But tell me a little bit as we go into your childhood, your background, your story. And we have the whole hour with you, so however long you want to go into that. But tell me what story and background you have that you want to share with our audience tonight that may be able to open their eyes and help them with their own problems.
That would be the beginning. And I'm going to start with when I first met you at the CCAP conference, where Michael was president and you spoke. And you spoke to the audience. After you spoke, it was so inspiring to me. I wanted to get in line with the others, but that line was so long to talk to you. So I thought it was kind of funny that now's the first time I get you one-on-one in front of everybody.
Yeah.
But where your story and mine met was when you mentioned in your book, Shattered by the Darkness, that your family members were prominent people in society. And it was the same for me. And so from the time my mom married my stepfather, about in fourth grade, and it lasted through ninth grade, he was a prominent member in our society here in Fresno. I don't know a better term to call it than society. Mm-hmm. But when I was able to speak about the abuse, it didn't take years. My mom suspected something. And so she got my aunt to talk to me and I opened up. And I told her all about the years of sexual abuse that my stepfather had for me. And my mom, and this, you have to remember, this is back in the 1980s. So this is a kind of a different time frame than today. Mm-hmm. But back then I was told that when we ended up in counseling, I was told that 99% of mothers at that time did not believe their children. That was the statistics at the time that I was told. So I'm hoping that still, you know, is correct. But I've always kind of remembered that. So it was reassuring that my mom believed me, and it went right to court. There, he got arrested immediately. There was no waiting, you know, years down the line like yourself or a lot of people, you know, that weren't able to come out into the open. I had family members that pursued it because they knew something was wrong. And it affected my entire family, and not just the immediate. It spread out through all the fingers of a family. My real dad didn't know how to react to that. He kind of ended up being standoffish. We went through a lot of counseling, many years, and it took its toll. So, but we were able to, you know, get through the worst of it. There were a couple years of court. I don't really want to dive into the details. All I know is that the court part at that time when it hit Fresno County was the biggest court case in Fresno County at the time.
Wow. Now, so, this was because you mentioned it started like when you was in fourth grade?
Yes.
Okay, so, and it went all the way till you was in ninth grade?
Right.
Okay, so we're talking, 9 years old to...
1982-ish. And so from ninth grade, oh, you're talking about how old I was?
Yeah.
So from 9 to about 14.
Okay, so about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, someone noticed something different. Did you come out and say, hey, this is happening? Or did somebody approach you in the family and said, hey, Darlene, is something wrong?
I had an aunt who was not my biological aunt, but she was like my second mom. And when my mom was getting ready to leave, because my mom had had enough, there had been a lot of arguing between my stepfather and her. A lot of times I didn't want to go on trips. And, you know, they would argue and she didn't know why, you know, and then I was brainwashed by my stepfather, and he would constantly tell me if I told anyone, it would break up the family and your mom wouldn't like that. And so, and it was hard. And I was a quiet child. I wasn't, you know, I didn't act out in aggression a lot or anything like that. I was really kind of mellow, which if you ask Michael, I still am. And so my aunt noticed some things. And so she was the one that confronted myself. And I was able to have a conversation with her, like you and I are having, and was able to dive into all the details that, you know, that she kind of needed to know. From there, you know, they called my doctor. And of course, when I told my doctor, then it went into the court system. And it had to be, I mean, there was no way out of it. The court wasn't the easiest either to go through, you know, it was pretty hard. And at that time, I don't know how they are now, be honest with you. But I know at that time, there was no protections for the children who were in court. I know I was talking to Michael about this earlier, that at the time I was doing, they were talking about, you know, like placing the child in the other room with a video camera and that, but at that time they didn't. So I literally was facing him every day, and it went on for like 2 years because, you know, they'd have cancellations. And then there was the fact that it didn't happen just in Fresno County. It was in Orange County and in between. I mean, there are different places. Eventually they all decided to, let Fresno County handle all of it. And then that's where the biggest court case came about. So it was huge. But
did you have siblings?
Yes, I did. I have a brother.
Okay. Nothing older or younger?
He's younger.
Okay. Was anything involved with him?
Yeah, it was both of us.
Okay. So the court case covered both?
Yes. Right.
Wow.
Yeah. And I know my stepfather had three boys, And we never, knew exactly what happened with them, but it's just kind of the belief that, it probably, happened there as well. It just seemed to trickle down. But, we don't really know, of course.
Darling, can you, without, and you can go into it as deep as you want, and I honor that most definitely. How did you handle those days? Do you remember how you coped through the early days of that happening to you as a child?
The actual abuse.
Yes.
Okay, so yes, I remember. I can still see myself in my bedroom, and like he would come in and he would say something to me. One time was like, something about my butt being too big, or it would be too big if I got, fat. And I remember closing the door and just squatting down and crying, wishing that my mom could go back to my dad, or I could just go to my dad. In my eyes at the time, that was my only safety net that I could think of, because I was still really young. It was late elementary and then junior high, and I didn't know of a way to get safe or to be safe. And a lot of times I would just tune out, and just kind of go blank. There was nothing else to do because I didn't have, you didn't hear a lot about people, and families that this was happening to. So I had no way to know how to get to be safe, if that makes sense.
Did it affect your schoolwork, your friends, your self-esteem while you was growing up? Did anything spiral out of control in that realm? And what kind of student did you become after this became a pretty involved abuse situation?
School was my safe zone, so school was good.
That's good.
And the only time it started to spiral was when everything came out in the open. Everything started being talked about in ninth grade, and I was talking to everybody, doctors, lawyers, therapists, and then the therapist would have me, like get a steno paper and just start writing down when I would remember stuff, because apparently I had blacked out a lot of memories in that short of, well, not short amount of time, 5 years. But so having to relive all that and be in court and talking to everybody, rehashing those 5 years over and over again, and court went on for a few years. That was the hardest time of my life. And high school's not easy anyway.
Right.
And so that's where my grades started slipping, and I started acting out. I ditched. I had to repeat classes. I was lucky to graduate still on time, but I had to retake a few classes. But the amazing thing that happened in high school, amongst all this that was going on in my life, was I had a few friends that I had during this time frame in from elementary school that they ended up in high school with me, because we kind of all went our separate ways for a minute, and then we all came back together. And we had a couple of new people in the little group too, that we had probably about five or six of us, all female. And I had just had it, and I told them, I said, I'm going through some stuff right now. And so I opened up and I was talking to these friends, and something really amazing happened. All I mean, and not it's not in a well, okay, I'm just gonna say it how it is. One by one, each of these girls had gone through something very similar to what I had gone through. And they have never been able to talk about it or open up to anybody until I had opened up and spoke what happened to me. And then hearing each of their stories one by one. One was raped by a stranger. One was one of her father, actual father, had gotten a hold of her and took her down to Mexico and sold her and beat her. And so a lot of these horrific things that I was listening to, and I'm like, so I'm not like the only one. And, you know, even though it was a bad situation, what happened to them, it strengthened all of us in the little group we had. But the bad part about that was, is when I went to court and I talked to the lawyer, they asked me if I had talked to anybody else about what happened to me. And I was like, well, yeah, you know, because it's just, I found a group of people. And then they wanted to know who the friends were. And I wouldn't tell them. And so I think things have changed since then. But that was one thing that I did stand on. I didn't care if I got in trouble. But that was my only thing that I could hold to myself with everything that happened. And I wasn't going to tear it, you know, end up tearing it up by letting everybody know who I talked to.
Right. So, I tell you what, we're going to take our first break. On the other side of this break, let's I want to dig into just a little bit of how that stepfather, what that relationship was termed, and then what happened after that, the aftermath of all the different relationships that you had gone through, some bad choices, how it affected you in a few and several years following that court case and after it was over and how it affected your life. So we're going to talk about that, dig a little deeper. If you want to get involved, 888-627-6008. It looks like I'm getting all kinds of texts, which is good. That means people are listening and you're hitting heartstrings. But call in, let us know what your thoughts and your comments are. Get on Facebook, Shattered by the Darkness Facebook, comment on there. And my son Curtis is there watching that right now to make sure if you have a comment, he'll pass that on to us. We'll be right back after our first commercial break for the second segment of Breaking the Silence with Darlene Pritchard. We'll be right back. Finally coming very soon will be the release of my second book in the three-part trilogy, Overcoming the Darkness, The Roadmap to Hope. Now, this book will be an in-depth look at the many different facets and emotions that a person goes through when they're experiencing anxiety and trauma in their life, and they're simply searching for hope. And an exciting addition to this book will be a companion journal guide that will come along with it. Also, there's going to be something that I'm very excited about, the youth version of this book called When Dark Clouds Come, The Roadmap to Hope. And it's going to be an excellent tool and guide for teenagers dealing with stress in their lives. So stay tuned for the release date coming very, very soon for these exciting new resources. Now back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams on the BBS Radio Network. All righty, welcome back. And Shattered by the Darkness is still doing pretty good. I just noticed this week it got down to like number eight, or got up to number eight on the selling list. So somebody's still buying that. And I think it was because I had a couple speaking gigs up in Wisconsin with the Crimes Against Children conference up there that had a huge response and a good response. And if you want to get online and find out more about what we're doing, we'd love to have you get involved and help us out. And 888-627-6008. We have Darlene Pritchard with us tonight from Fresno, California, and she's telling us about her story. And Darlene, on the when things started to, like, your aunt got involved and said, hey, wait, something's going on, tell me the story. What kind of stress, trauma, situation did that put you in at that point? How did that actually end? Which one thing I want to applaud is that your mom believed you, because I think that seems to be one of the biggest horrific parts of stories parents don't believe. So tell me kind of how that played out there when the story came out and it was the finger was pointing to him.
That was probably the most relieving part of my sexual abuse trauma, was my aunt actually confronting me and making me speak. And being able to tell her, and her being and listening intently, and, you know, and she would have to speak and draw things out of me, you know, because I didn't know quite how to tell her or what have you. But that was the biggest relief I had had.
Yeah, paint that conversation for me just a little bit. How did that play out?
I can't give you the exact words because it's been a few years.
Right.
But she would ask me, she would say, just, did he do anything to you? And you can tell me, you can talk to me because I'm here. We're going to protect you. He's not, if he did, he's not going to cause any more trouble. And she was really reassuring. And she let me know, too, that my mom was behind her, too. It's just they felt that with my aunt, it would be easier for me to talk to her, which it was. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to tell your mom things like that, you know. And I watched my mom go through her own trauma with this as well. So it was hard on all of us. But my aunt was really good with speaking to me and getting the truth out. And then she kind of, then they would let me know what they had planned to do. And, you know, I didn't know how any of it would play out. So I just went, my mom was behind me. That's all I knew. And so I just followed my mom's lead on everything after that. And, but as far as what happened, you know, for the next few years in high school, that's when my addiction started. That's when I started trying different, you know, drugs. Well, mainly marijuana and drinking. I would drink every chance I could get to try and numb, because having to relive stuff over and over again, it was just monotonous. It just drove me insane. And then I had met the girl's dad, my two girls, and we got married, and I still drank. And they were born, and we ended up splitting up. And from there on, it just seemed like I always wanted that knight in shining armor and that white picket fence, you know, that every girl's told that she should have. And anybody that would show me attention, I thought that, you know, they would give that to me. And so for like the next 10 years, I was in and out of different relationships, which was traumatizing to my girls, you know. And then right around the age of 30, my addiction took a more horrific turn. And I found out what methamphetamine was. I was trying to hold down a job, go to school, and take care of the girls and be in my own place. And for a single mother with two kids with no real education, it was super hard. And so somebody showed me, you know, what methamphetamine can do and how I could stay awake. Well, that was the start of a 7-year stint of my drug addiction.
Is it true? I have a family member that was in rehab with meth. And this has been years ago. And she told me the first attempt at taking it, she was immediately hooked on meth. Was that the same issue with you when you tried it, when you took a drag or whatever, however you take it? Did it immediately hook you?
No, what the hook was for me was the fact that it would help me stay awake. So if I didn't have it, you know, there was a downtime to it. But, you know, I always wanted to be able to stay awake, and that's what made me chase it. As far as my body going through severe withdrawals, it didn't really go through severe withdrawals if I didn't have it. I have, Michael and I have many conversations on this, so he's more of the technical one, but some people have, you know, they become more addicted than other people. Mine was more of a means to an end. I was able to stay awake. It was something I always wanted to have. I could focus. And so at one point in time when I was in school, I was going to school during the day for 8 hours, get off work, take care of the girls, and then I would go work at the bar and be up all night and then go back to school the next day. And so it was just a relentless cycle. But then it turned more severe. Then I didn't want to get rid of it. And I ran into a different crowd and it became more intense. At one point in time, I was an IV drug user for a couple months. And that took me almost to the dirt. And that's when the end started coming in and I got arrested for the first time. And going to jail for the first time was probably the most scariest thing besides court that I've ever gone through. And that's when I learned about, well, I had a couple programs in the beginning, you know, they wanted me to go to that I didn't go to because I was still active in my addiction. And then that's during that time I was with a guy that I want to try and say this and not divulge too much as far as he goes, but this was the relationship that turned to domestic violence. And I was with him for a few years. But when I finally had enough of going to jail, testing dirty, in and out of probation, you know, and there was one final time. And what finally was the breaker to where I finally stopped was I had been arrested and I was going in front of the judge. And this is where prison was held over my head. And for the very first time during my addiction, my mom was in the audience.
I can imagine that, I don't know if shame or that embarrassment of mom watching you go through this, right?
Yeah, because before, you know, all the years before, she knew I was in my addiction. She's seen the horrific places that I had lived in and what have you. Actually seeing her in the audience, it renewed my strength. And I knew I could get out of this, but it would take, you know, a lot of work on my end. It wasn't something that you could just snap your fingers and say all the bad stuff go away.
Right.
And so I was introduced to what they called at that time PCDC, which was post-conviction drug court. And Judge Nancy Cisneros was my judge here in town. And I learned what a caring judge could be. And she was like the second mom, you know, as far as she took care of all her people that went to drug court. And she cared. She had a heart. And she was very inspirational to me and to my mom because we got to have lunch with her one time. But all these little things led to me becoming clean. It was a process. It was not an easy thing. Post-conviction drug court, they random tested you. They could test you every day of the week if they wanted you to. But, you know, over time, as you, you know, showed them you were able to stay clean, they lessened the leash on you. And they taught you the skills you needed to be able to go back out into society. You know, I was able to go back and start working as a stylist once I got clean and sober. And we do need to talk about the domestic violence piece because that there was very strenuous. And as I was becoming clean, he was not. And I had to make a tough decision to leave. And his parents had given him a stable home and he for all of us to live in, but he would not stay clean. And I remember my youngest daughter, it was in August, they were arguing, actually, I was arguing with him because I found more paraphernalia, and it was on her birthday. And I told her, I go, I'm done, I'll find a way out. And the following month, I left, and it was hard. And I had to go into a shelter because I knew he would come search me out. And it from the day I left September 1st, 2016, no, it's 2006. I'm sorry, 2006. From that point forward, the next year and a half was pretty rough. Yeah, it was about a year. But I left September 1st, left him, stayed in the shelter for about a couple of weeks, and then I went to stay with my cousin, who helped support and take care, offered shelter for me. And 2 months later, because the ex-boyfriend was finding out where I was at, he ended up burning the house down that I was living in. And I was in, it was my cousin and her husband and my second cousin. And we narrowly got out. I have a hearing issue and always have had. So he had to wake me up and shake me awake. And the house was already half gone by the time I was awake. But so it was a hard thing. And he, I did everything that they tell you to do. The cops say get a restraining order. I did that. In fact, I showed up in the next day. That morning of the fire was my first day in court for the restraining order, and it was so booked. And the judge was like, we're real busy. If we can postpone any of you guys, we'll postpone you to a certain date. And I couldn't. I knew my life was on the line, and I stayed, and he listened to me, and the ex was in court, and he made that restraining order extend to December, when we had to postpone it. And finally in December we were able to get the restraining order fully activated for 3 years. However, it didn't stop. He still chased us down for the next 6 months. Yeah, it was about 6 months. He still actively pursued me. And about the time I met Michael in church, and that I started going to the church that a friend of mine had told me, and I had been going for a few months. But it's about that time frame that he finally stopped. And he had found somebody else to harass. And I thank God every day for that. I mean, that was just it. I didn't, everywhere I went, he was causing mayhem. He'd leave stuff on the doorstep. One time at my mom's house, he poured some kind of sticky substance down, and we couldn't even get out of the driveway, and hazmat had to be called out. And just, stuff like that. And I felt like it wasn't going to end. But a lot of praying and a lot of support, and it finally did. So, and then insert Michael.
We're going to insert Michael on the other side of this break. And on this last segment, Darlene, I want to not only talk about, how Michael got involved and how life is now, and the impacts that maybe this impact that trauma still has on you today. I mean, I'm still impacted, and I want to kind of find out that. And then I want to turn that final corner into hope, of how people can find hope if they're sitting there in their home right now, knowing that their husband's going to walk through the door and batter them shortly. How can they find hope in their own situation right now? So join us 888-627-6008 if you want to get involved. We'll be back right after this last commercial break for our last segment on Breaking the Silence. Be right back.
From HCI Publishing, that brought you the international bestsellers, A Child Called It, and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years, and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
All righty, welcome back to the final segment. We have Darlene Pritchard here, and we're getting ready to turn the corner of her meeting Michael and Michael coming back into the picture, or however that relationship got started or going, and talking about her life and her story and the abuse, the court case, the choices, the toxic relationships, and then maybe... There's no doubt. I'm saying maybe out of being silly. Answer prayer, right? How was your prayers answered?
So we have to start with the fact that I was going to church at this time. And this church was unlike any other church Michael and I had gone to. And I hadn't met him yet when I started going. And so and I had a lot of support from the church in helping me, because one of the things that my stalker did, my ex-boyfriend, is he developed these missing posters, and it would say missing and it'd have my picture and it'd say call him, and he posted them all through the church parking lot. And so the pastor's like, what the heck's going on? And so I told him, you know, everything that was going on. He knew about the house burning down. And so they were a huge support. And I was thankful for that. So I learned about prayer, and I learned about praying to God for things and support and strength. And I was praying so hard for him to help me through all of this. I knew there had to be a better end game in time. And I knew I just had to go through it. And I had supports around me. So I had everything, you know, that I needed. So I was praying to God, you know, I know that I've had a lot of relationships, and I just pray, Lord, that I don't want a boyfriend. I don't want a husband. I just, Lord, let me focus on you. And so I was praying to not have a husband. Well, while I was praying to not have a husband, Michael was praying that he wanted a wife. And so the joke is, or the story is that he won. He has God's favor because he got the wife. So we met at the same church, and it was at the tail end. So he was supportive of me and everything that I was going through. I told him the whole story. It took a minute before we started, you know, officially dating and what have you. But he became my strength. When we started dating, he was there every morning at the apartment. I had actually gotten my own apartment. I had a job, got my own apartment with the girls, and he would be there every morning and pray with me every morning before he'd go to work and before I would go to work. And, you know, I'd cook him breakfast, what have you. And so it really started, and we'd pray a lot. And we, you know, he'd teach me the Bible. His understanding of the Bible is amazing to me. And so, you know, it was really awesome. So we got married. We got married January 2008. And we stayed in different places. You know, we kind of bounced around, kind of like we were still in our addiction is what it made me think about. But eventually we had one of the churches we were at, that they had a rental house. And so we had a roommate, and there were three of us. It was really good because Michael sings. He didn't tell you that part. But so one of the guys the guy that stayed with us, the roommate, he sang too. And so Michael and him harmonized beautifully. And I used to love hearing it come through the house, and it was really awesome. But there's this one time where I had to have a surgery, and I want to think it was my cancer surgery because I'm a survivor of cancer. And that was kind of interesting to go through, and a lot of prayer. But God's always great in the end. But I remember being at the kitchen window one time, and I was doing dishes, and I love having a window in the kitchen. And I was looking out, and I looked over, and I saw my ex-boyfriend's truck that I thought he gave to his son. And so when you ask about what it's done to me, I started breaking out in a sweat. I started shaking, but my first thing I did is I called Michael. But I couldn't function. I just went into shock. And I just kind of, even though he couldn't see me, I squatted down, and come to find out he had gotten his truck back from his son, and he was driving it around. And his girlfriend at the time lived across the street, or her family did, or somebody. And so he was visiting, and that was really. So yeah, it probably would still do that to me today, just because it was it, you just I never knew what to expect of him, and I just never knew what the next thing would be. So insert Michael, we stayed married, that ended. I never saw the ex again. Life was grand. We've gone through college. Michael had to drag me through it because I just something I didn't want, not, I mean, I didn't want to do it, but, and now both of us actually, I guess, as far as the eyes of the world go, we're successful in what we do. I love HR and he loves what he does. I mean, mostly. And here we are. So,
It seems like after hearing the, I'm sure not the whole story, but a sure good bird's eye view of it, that a couple people ought to be applauded in your life. Number one, your aunt and your mom for believing.
right.
That is huge. How did that affect your relationship with your children and that kind of communication that you have now, and how would you give advice to parents that are listening? Hey, this is what you need to do with your kids.
Yeah, it's if you know what warning signs are, you need to speak to your kids. My mom and my relationship then and now, then during and now, is as strong as it's ever been. And the same with my girls. I guess the best way to put it is my son-in-law calls my girls, me and my mother, the trifecta.
That's right, Fedra.
Because we're bound together, but we're strong women, and we'll see. We'll get through whatever adversity comes through our lives, no matter what it is.
Is your mom listening tonight?
I'm not sure, but
Okay, she is. Hey, Mom, good job.
yes. And unfortunately, my aunt passed a year or so ago. So, but she I always thanked her for that too. But as far as parents go, is to listen to your kids. Look for if something's changing in their school or their environment, ask, find out why. Don't just put them on the side. There's something going on. And don't put a blind eye to it because they're going to need somebody. And if nothing else, believe your children if you don't try and get help. But that's where I would be with that.
Yeah, because without that, Darlene, where would you have been?
Exactly. I had a dad who didn't want to believe it, but, and so I kind of saw both sides to a point, even though I did want to escape to my dad. That was my only safe zone. But yeah, without my mom believing me, I feel like it would have just never ended. And those friends that I talked to you about, that's what I listened to, is that nobody would believe them. And it continued, you know, for the ones that it was the father or the stepfather.
Now that you're on the other side of this, years down the road, what, 2006, 2009, you met Michael, and now you're in the, 2021. And you look back and you notice that everybody in that friend circle had a similar story, maybe in different areas and different degrees. How prevalent do you think this kind of problem is in our world today? Well, what kind of wisdom have you obtained from listening to Michael and in your own personal experiences? What kind of problem do we have with child abuse in our world right now?
I think it's very serious. I don't think it's lessened any from when I was abused, because every aspect of my life, every year of my life, if I met somebody, talked with different people, different circles, there was always somebody. Even when I was dating the girls, my children's dad. So this is late teens, early 20, well, late teens. I remember meeting somebody and we became close friends. And it was her father, and it was affecting all of her siblings, or all of her siblings. And so we had a long conversation about what to expect if she did this or that. She, you know, she believed her sisters and that, and she already knew. But it never stopped from there, you know. So it was the high school friends, it was the friends after high school, it was the church friends and all the ones in between. It's something that I've never stopped talking about, and I never will stop talking about it, because every time we talk about it, somebody's listening and somebody needs to know what to do.
Yeah. Do you think your story, because you started off by saying, if you would have got a hold of me after that conference that day that I spoke, that what resonated between the two of us was that you were in a good neighborhood, a fluid family, per se, leaders in the community, and this happened to you. I don't think we can even fathom. I think we overlook that whole category. And we always say, oh, that happens to people on the other side of the tracks in the bad parts of town. And it's just not the case.
It's not. And it's just kind of makes me think of what Michael says about people who do drugs. Drugs don't, they're not. It doesn't care who you are. You know, it doesn't matter what level of life you're at. There's a phrase you have. Sorry, Michael's right here. But there's a phrase he has, because it doesn't discriminate.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing for sexual abuse. It doesn't discriminate. It doesn't matter who you are, where you come from. It can affect everybody. And I'm not saying it happens to everybody, but there's all walks of life. And it's a tough one to get through.
Yeah. But there's hope, right? I mean, you're on the other side of it.
Oh, there's always hope. There's always hope. And then once you do get through it, what do you do with it then?
Oh, yeah. What do you do with it?
You start talking and you don't stop talking.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I've talked, so this is really good, and I appreciate you having me on.
It's my honor. Do you feel the same way I do? Every time you tell it, you heal a little bit more?
There's a little terror because you remember, because sometimes it's like, I'm at a point now in my life where it seems like I don't think about it as often. So there's a little terror, but there's a lot more healing on top of that.
Yeah.
So that scars, you know, is building. And so I could never not talk about it.
That's great. We have about 1 minute left before we have to go. Darlene, what would you say to somebody in a quick nutshell if they're going, wow, that sounds like me now? Not years ago, but they're in it now. What would you tell them? What kind of advice would you have if you were right there in front of them, eyeball to eyeball?
I would tell them to seek out somebody who will listen and somebody that's safe. Teachers, doctors, anybody in that kind of avenue where there's a safe place where they can talk to. Because those are our mandated reporters and they have to protect you. And it's not an easy thing to do, but it'll get you into a safe spot.
Fantastic. Well, I'll tell you what, darling, it was great having you with us tonight. I appreciate you sharing your story. I want you to thank your husband for sharing you for an hour with us tonight. And thank you so much for the friendship. And I hope to get to see you again out in California. And this time we'll stop and talk.
Okay.
So we don't have to do it via Zoom.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight. And it's like we always do every week, each and every week. You've heard this story, and these stories aren't to traumatize you. These stories are to tell you that people go through issues like this all the time. And I love these when they have these endings of saying, wait, look what happened. So no matter what situation you're in right now, I want to let you know, like we just talked about, there's hope. There's always hope. Don't pull away from it. Lean into it each and every moment. And if you're in a situation right now, Doug's going to tell you my phone number, how to get in touch with me. Text me. Let me know what's going on, and I'll connect a time up to talk with you. And we'll help you through that if you have nobody else to go to. But always remember, no matter what, there's hope. Join us next week right here for another edition. We're going to have James Carey with us next week, 8 o'clock Central Time, live from Houston, Texas, for another edition on Labor Day weekend of Breaking the Silence. Have a great week. God bless. And take care of yourselves, okay? Be safe out there. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1. For the next episode of Breaking the Silence.